powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
This is Jake and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Ross.
I don't know if we'll ever see another game exactly like the one we saw on Monday night when a quarterback attempts just three passes, completes two of them. In fact, I don't think I read this on ESPN.
What are you talking about? It's the new wave, Stacey.
That's exactly right. I don't think that a team had had that few pass completions in a game since, I think, 1978. Ironically, it was the Bills that did that. I want to say that's what ESPN Stats and Info had. But either way, you look at it, you look at the context, and you say, 40-mile-per-hour wind gust, it's snowy, it's disgusting out. Of course they're going to run the ball. Whatever. This is dumb. This is a dumb conversation. That's the context of it. But it's also fascinating. Here's why. Because it brought up conversations not about whether or not teams could win games throwing the ball only three times. Like, if that was your takeaway from this game, if you left this game thinking, like, you know what, the NFL doesn't need quarterbacks. I don't know how to help you. Like, I really don't. I really don't. Good luck playing in a dome. But I also think that if you left this game thinking, wow, Bill Belichick, like, what an interesting decision. And is this a pattern of decisions he's made over his coaching career that's led to his success? That is a conversation I'm more interested in, because I think the answer is yes.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with you. I think Bill Belichick, one of his greatest trait as a coach, honestly, has been his game planning. I mean, you talk about Bill Belichick and the way that he has gone about game planning, the way that he has been adaptable, malleable, going in from year to year, going in from game to game. I think that's been his greatest strength and his greatest hallmark as a coach in the NFL. Sure, you could talk about his personality and his not so informational press conferences and all of that, but his number one trait that I view as, outside of him being an exceptional defensive mind and defensive coach, has been that concept of adaptability. And, you know, there hasn't been anybody in the league that has done it like him and has mastered it like him and has been able to make it successful for not just a year or two, but for two decades.
Now, I don't want to turn into just a show. We just talked about Tom Brady in the Man in the Arena documentary, which I do want to watch. I do want to watch. I'm glad you mentioned it. Now we're talking about how brilliant Bill Belichick is. Like, I got to, like, dust this off a little bit.
Right. So I'll throw in good.
I'll throw in a little bit of shade. This is Bill's head coach, Sean McDermott.
Let's not give more credit than we need to give credit to Bill Belichick in this one. It was, whether it's Bill or anybody else, they beat us, right? You sit here and you tell me when we start with the average starting field position of the 40-yard line and he starts with the 23-yard line, and I'm rounding up in both cases, and we were 1-for-4 in the red zone and they were 0-for-1 in the red zone, you give me that ahead of time, I'm saying I like my chances. I like my chances.
Now, he's not wrong. The Patriots started the game, Curtis, correct me if I'm wrong if you do know this, throwing against the wind or throwing into the wind. No, that's the same. Throwing with the wind, the way that the Patriots started the game, the wind favored the Patriots and not the Bills, is what I'm saying.
Correct.
You had a missed field goal. You had the Patriots team that went like 2 of 12. They were like 16% on third down.
Yeah.
If you watched the game and sat and watched, especially the first quarter, you take out an explosive run and you're like, man, they're getting nowhere fast. What's this going to be? It's not like they came in and it's not like no other coach would approach that game and think, we should run the ball. We should run the ball. Like, all the Bills should have done is run the ball more with Josh Allen.
I mean, I watched the game from the second quarter on. I didn't get to see the first quarter because we were out taking Santa pictures as a family.
I saw that. They were adorable.
The kids, they look great. It was a lot of fun to see River. You know, she didn't smile, but she just her jowls right now. Her cheeks are so
big.
She
didn't scream, and that's the important.
No, she will next year. So Jackson was an angel as a baby. Bodie was an angel as a baby. Then they get to one, and then Santa becomes a little scary. Both kids, Jackson and Bodie, have crying faces when they were one.
You guys should make a super cut of all the pictures of anyone listening, of your children screaming at Mall Santa's.
I'm fully anticipating that River's going to do the same next year. But this year, it was great. It was perfect. No one cried. Actually, we sat Bodie on Santa's lap, and he did cry. So we moved him to, like, there was a wooden horse prop that we put him on, and he was great. He was fine after that. But after that, we went to Red Robin, where they got TVs and everything, and I sat there and watched the game.
I was like, where are we going, Jake? And you know what? We will follow you into the darkness,
just,
my friend. Where are we going?
Just follow me. Just follow me. Like Doug Baldwin to Russell Wilson, okay? But sitting there and watching the game, and I agree. I there wasn't anything about the game plan that I looked at and said, wow, this is extra creative. It was literally, we are going to line up and we are going to play smash mouth football and try to stop us.
I frankly thought the Bills tried a bit more creativity offensively. It just didn't work
out. They did. Yeah, exactly.
You saw the pre-snap motion or the, yeah.
In passing, and honestly, the Bills were able to pass relatively fine. Josh Allen
got a great arm.
He does, and he was inaccurate at times. Stephon Diggs misplays a beautiful thrown go ball that literally hits his arm. So there were a lot of mistakes that the Bills made, but seeing the reaction of, wow, the Patriots are geniuses, the Bill Belichick is a genius, I just think that he knows the right buttons to press and the right game plan to go in with each and every single week. Doesn't mean it works out all the time, but I think that he knows his teams exceptionally well and plays to their strengths and leans into their strengths. And that is one thing, Stacey, that has really frustrated me about the Seattle Seahawks over the years. And honestly, in the past 6 years of, you know, really holding to that concept of being adaptable and being able to adapt to the strengths of your roster, adapt to, given games where you are really malleable from week to week. And it doesn't mean that they, haven't done that and done that successfully. I mean, we just, we're on with Bob Condotta, and if you missed him, you can download our show at 710sports.com or wherever you get your podcasts. But he talked about, hey, look, I went to Next Gen Stats. Russell Wilson has gotten the ball out relatively quickly, and they do that against the 49ers because they have a great front. They've done that for years, right? So they know specifically into that week how to game plan for that opponent. I wish that you could see that from week to week with each opponent that they play, like the New England Patriots. And that, to me, is something that has been missing with this crew and this group, and which is part of the reason why, if you have a philosophy like Pete Carroll, which is, his philosophy isn't wrong. There's nothing inherently wrong or that has passed him by about his philosophy. But the problem is, if you don't have the personnel to execute that philosophy, you're stuck. You got nowhere to go. And and there hasn't really been an answer to how you get the most out of the roster that you have that doesn't fit your philosophy that you deeply, deeply believe in.
I think I have an answer to this, but I think you have a quicker one. Where is Bill Belichick adapted? If we're talking about it, I'm kind of removing a little bit this game from it, because I don't know. This game is on its face a great example of adaptability, but you dig a little deeper and it's like you did what you had to do. What's an example then of, hey, this is a time when Belichick did something that the Seahawks could have, should have done, but didn't?
What I would say is the transition from a defensive-oriented team when Tom Brady was there.
2002-3.
Yeah, 2001. Yeah, 2002 to 2004-5. They had an amazing defense, a front seven that was out of this world. And then they were a run-oriented offense with Tom Brady being a game manager and putting them in the right positions. They sound very similar to Legion of Boom era, right? I mean, and then Bill Belichick and Tom Brady, they transition into a heavy passing offense, and they explode onto the scene. And they've got Randy Moss, they've got Wes Welker. You go down the list, and then they add, Rob Gronkowski and Aaron Hernandez, and they just change the way that they go about their offense. But, you could look at that evolution offensively, but how about defensively? They are not the same style defense now that they were back then either.
How are they different? How are they different in a way that has nothing to do with NFL rules?
Well, so difference between NFL rules, I think that that's hard because
I know. Well,
they have evolved with the NFL rules.
Okay.
But what I would say is
different?
The difference is that, okay, in their first iteration, the defense for Bill Belichick, they were great front seven, dominant front seven. That was really where it was. Willie McGinnis, that whole crew, Trenches. Teddy Bruschi. I mean, they had great DB play, but that's really where the heart of the defense was. Whereas now you look at it today, they've got a tremendous pass rush, and it is led by their DBs. They've got a great crop of DBs, and they play a lot of dime package, and they really get after it, and they do an excellent job that way. So they're more of a finesse defense now than they were back then. and the game has changed and it has evolved, and Bill Belichick has evolved with that. So I think that that part of it to me is really where you look at it. You can look at it offensively, you can look at it defensively, and the ways that they've changed and evolved.
I think I worry that someone might be mishearing you, thinking you're saying the Seahawks should be a pass-heavy offense. I hear it more as in that kind of middle tenure, they should have been more than they were, or like they should have been more balanced. Like in 2018, in hindsight, should have thrown the ball a bit more in that wild card game. I think what I'm hearing now is like the problem now is when you talk about the issues of adaptability this year. What are you talking about?
When talking about this year, I think it goes down to roster construction. I think it goes down to how are you building your team and what is your team built like, and then how are you making the most of it? That's why the Jamal Adams conversation is so intriguing to me, because you have a defensive player that you gave up all this capital for, and yet you're not using him in the way that highlights his particular strengths. That's unique. That's different. You've got a offense that if Pete Carroll has a philosophy of running the football and being a balanced offense and controlling time of possession, your offensive line is not reflective of that. And so how do you combat that? I think that that's a more difficult answer to give, but those are things that you point to. And when I say adaptable, the true mark of an adaptable, balanced offense is being able to be successful in both areas. If the game requires you to be a run-heavy attack, that you can do so and do so very effectively. If the game requires you to be a pass-heavy oriented offense that particular week, you can do so and do so effectively.
Dallas and Arizona.
Yeah, I mean, it's just you look at those differences. To me, it's just that's a truly balanced approach and a balanced attack that, you know, we just have not seen them be able to be consistent that way offensively and defensively. We have not been able to see them execute the philosophy that makes Pete Carroll's defense great.
This hour of Jake and Stacey is brought to you by King's Heating and Air. Let's get to Four Down Territory.
This is Four Down Territory, brought to you by Genuine Auto Glass. Going inside the game with quarterback guru Jake Heaps.
Jake Heaps played in the NFL, played quarterback, was in the room with him, was in the fire. He's really a guru. He really played the game.
First down, Jake. The New England Patriots beat the Buffalo Bills with just 3 pass attempts, 2 completions last night in Monday Night Football. It's exciting. Big change for the league, Jake. You're going to have the wing tee offense. Number one look. Fullback's going to get drafted number one overall. I'm excited for it. What was your reaction to this game?
I mean, my reaction was great job by Bill Belichick looking at the game, understanding the way that he wanted to win and what he best saw their chances to win, given the factoring in the weather, factoring in the idea of on the road in Buffalo, you know, 30 to 50 mile an hour gusts of wind, and saying, hey, I'm not going to put any pressure on my rookie quarterback, and I'm not going to risk the chances of him turning the ball over when I believe we can turn this into a knock 'em, sock 'em out type of game where our defense is going to lead the charge, going to give Josh Allen and the Buffalo Bills fits as they try to attempt to throw the football in this weather. And we're just going to try to play ball control offense, and we are not going to turn the football over. And that is what they chose to do. And it wasn't pretty. It's not like they won 30-0. They barely won the game. And the Bills really shot themselves in the foot multiple times. They won the field position battle. They missed field goals. They missed opportunities consistently throughout the game to capitalize, especially with the ball to finish the game in this final 2-minute drive. So I think that Bill Belichick did an amazing job of saying, this is what we're going to do to win. We're committed to it, and they executed that plan. I don't see this as a sign that all of a sudden, you know, the NFL is going to change, and here is the old school running attack, and the wing tee and I formation and run heavy is the new wave. I don't see that at all. I just think that this was a tremendous game plan, and it continues to keep showing that Bill Belichick continues to be adaptable, continues to be malleable, and does a fantastic job coaching his guys up, both offensively and defensively, Stacey, to show up for the moment and execute their game plans. And that's why, in my opinion, I mean, everybody's opinion, he's the greatest coach of all time.
All right, second down. Josh Allen was an MVP favorite to start the season. why I took him in my fantasy draft. I don't regret it, but I certainly wasn't happy about last night's performance. And neither was he, neither was the Bills. So, Jake, what is the problem that Josh Allen and the Bills offense keep running into?
Well, honestly, you look at the numbers for them team-wise, their rushing stats aren't terrible. So it's not like they don't have a running game, but it's not something that I think that when you talk about this offense, when push comes to shove, particularly in that game, it didn't show up for them at all. And they were not willing to lean into that side of the game. They really put it on Josh Allen's shoulders in a very difficult set of circumstances. And as they get closer to the playoffs, as they get closer to, you know, tougher games in December here, they have to find a way to get balanced. They have to find a way to make their offense effective, to continue to move the chains. And I think that that's one issue that they've ran into this year. Last year, they set the world on fire. Josh Allen was playing at an unbelievable level, and they were throwing the ball all over the yard. But when push comes to shove, you are going to need the run game. You're going to need it to be effective. And I think that that's what the Bills have really struggled in when they have had their losing efforts. So that's one thing that they've got to figure out, because their defense continues to play great.
Third down. Couple new coaching hires for UW and Wazoo. Not talking about head coach, I'm talking about OCs. So who are the new OCs, and what should fans make of the news?
Well, the new OCs for UW, it's Ryan Grubbs, who was the OC for Kalen DeBoer at Fresno State. So that to me is no surprise. I mean, you keep the band together and you understand what each other's strengths are. You understand how they work together. And Kalen DeBoer has a sounding board in Ryan Grubbs. So it makes a lot of sense to me. I think it's the appropriate hire. I wouldn't have expected anything other than that. And then for WSU, for Jake Dickert to go out and hire Eric Morris, it's a unique hire. You go back to the well of Mike Leach. Eric Morris had a tremendous success at a D3 school as he took over the head coaching duties there. They were one of the they came off of one winning season when he took over. He led them to the playoffs and nearly upset number one Sam Houston State. So incredible job there. Showed his coaching chops, and now he's going to get an opportunity to run the show offensively. I'll be curious to see how they make that transition. They did it effectively under Rolo, from going air raid to run and shoot. Now they're going to go back to the air raid. They also hired the offensive line coach that was there under Mike Leach, which I think was a crucial hire. So far, I like what they're doing offensively. And so far, I think both programs have made good decisions with their offensive coordinator hires.
Fourth down. Speaking of fourth down, fitting that this down is a question about aggressiveness. Should Pete Carroll continue the aggressive approach?
Yeah, I mean, he was asked by the media on this. Obviously, the aggressive nature in which he called the game, he approached this game versus San Francisco, was different than what we have seen. And a lot of people credit that to them being 3-8. I think that's appropriate. But here's another piece of information that Pete Carroll gives us here, Cut 6.
Sometimes it goes with the game, too. You know, I mean, there's a basic approach that we're trying to play really good football and trust that we're okay. And so that means you don't have to push the limits to try to get everything done right off the bat. That's basically how we go about stuff, and kick the ball deep and back them up and make them go 90 yards to score and let our defense do their thing. Our defense is playing well enough that we can play that way. Really, it depends, Greg, on, you know, it's not always as clear as it was this week, you know, and Niners, you know, all that. They've been playing so good. It had something to do with it. We thought we needed to match them up.
So he clearly looked at that as, yeah, 3-8, you got to spark something, you got to make something happen. But also, it was an ode to the 49ers, who he views as a very good football team, a team that obviously coming into the game had won 3 in a row. And so you saw Pete Carroll see that they needed to be more aggressive and take advantage of opportunities that they had to try and score points and generate points with a group that has struggled to do so pretty much all season long. So will that change now that they play the Houston Texans? Yes, it will. Because Pete Carroll views that team in particular that they don't need to play that way, that they can play a little bit more conservatively, and it's their best way to win the game and not put them in bad situations. So I don't see Pete Carroll, you know, electing to kick a 56-yard field goal with Jason Myers, for example. I see him punting the football in that situation. Do I expect to see, you know, aggressive calls on fourth down? I don't believe so. And I don't necessarily disagree with that. I would love to see it continue. I'd love to see the continued aggressive play. I've called for that. But I also understand from Pete Carroll's perspective of going into each week, the Seahawks are clearly the better team than the Houston Texans going into this one. They don't need to play desperately or try to manage the game desperately. They can, Pete Carroll can call the game in the way that he's most comfortable in and the way that they continue to like to play football.
All right, ESPN senior NHL writer Greg Wyshynski going to join us in just a couple minutes. Let's figure out whether the version we saw of the Kraken to start the year struggling is who they really are, or whether there's an actual middle ground, whether those improvements are real. We just saw an aberration last night. I don't know. Lots of questions for Greg. Don't go anywhere.
You're listening to Jake and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacey Rost.
Joining us now, let's talk Seattle Kraken with ESPN senior NHL writer Greg Wyshynski on the Emerald Queen Casino Sportsbook Hotline. Hey, Greg, how's it going?
It's going well. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, we're really excited to talk to you. I wish we had a more excitement to talk about as far as like great play, but that's why I'm especially eager to talk to you about it. So, Greg, you just had a column up on ESPN Plus, kind of with your goalie confidence rankings. Here's what I don't like: Seattle Kraken, number 32. I assume it has nothing to do with their decision to retire the number 32 jersey. And instead has to do with them being ranked last in save percentage. Are you as surprised as I am with how they rank here?
Yeah, I'm shocked. I mean, I think a lot of us saw the moves that were made leading up to the season, in particular the signing of Philip Grubauer, and really thought this could be the strength of the team, that this was going to be the bedrock on which the Kraken were going to build whatever they were going to build this season, be it a legit contender for a playoff spot, be it someone who comes close to the bubble. You know, to be where they are in the overall save percentage rankings in this league, which I believe is the bottom still, compared to how the team can play defensively in front of it. Now, keep in mind, I know a lot of people are down on the way that the Kraken have played in front of their goaltending, and maybe that should keep them off the hook for a lot of the problems the team has had. And when you look at the real 5-on-5 stats, yeah, the Kraken are not very good, but you look analytically at what they've been able to do as far as where teams are taking shots and where the scoring chances are coming from, and they've been quite good. So when that happens, when the analytics tell you the team is doing pretty well as far as expected goals against, and then they're not getting the results when it comes to actual goals against, I think that's when you start taking a hard look at what the goaltending is doing, and unfortunately the answer is not much this season.
So, Greg, the unique aspect about that is that you signed up for 6 years. Like, Philip Grubauer isn't going to go away anytime soon. So, how do you remedy this situation? Is it just better play by Grubauer? Is it, you know, is there other ways that, you know, they can help him out to see if he can improve his play over the course of the season?
Well, it's a combination of factors. I think, obviously, one aspect of the Kraken that's been really frustrating is Chris Driedger's inability to stay in the lineup for a variety of reasons. Mm. You know, he was going to be a big part of this. He came off a tremendous year with the Florida Panthers last season and was seen by many as a potential starter in this league for a team. I'm sure when he signed with Seattle, that was probably his design too, before the Grubauer move was made. But you know, him being only limited to a handful of games, I think, is hurt. With Grubauer, I talked to Steven Valiquette, who is a former NHL goaltender, runs an organization called Real Clear Stats, which is a tremendous group that tracks goaltender stats and really gets into the analytics behind who's playing well and who isn't. And Valiquette told me that when he watched Grubauer against the Rangers earlier this year, that you know, he wasn't really moving as well as he remembered Grubauer moving before. And in other words, he wasn't setting himself very well. He wasn't coming to a complete stop. He usually will track the pass, come to a complete stop, and then make a save, and then be in a position to make the next save. And what Valiquette told me is that Grubauer wasn't setting his feet before he would make his first save, and then was scrambling on the subsequent chances by an opponent. So that's something that you can easily kind of coach out of somebody. That's something that can be remedied. And, you know, when you see a player that in the past has had success, yeah, I mean, a change in system and a change in personnel in front of you is obviously going to impact a goaltender. But it's also, you know, the expectations placed on someone based on their contract, based on where they are in the world. I think about Sergei Bobrovsky going from the Columbus Blue Jackets to the Florida Panthers over the last couple of years and the weight of that contract breaking his back basically for a couple seasons before he found his game again this year. And I imagine it's probably the same thing for Grubauer. It's the weight of a contract and the expectations placed on you when you start becoming the belle of the free agent ball like he was.
Do you personally see his performance itself devoid of expectations as a bit more of an aberration or like a one-off?
Man, I hope so. You know, I have not always been the strongest advocate for Philip Grubauer. I felt like he was a goaltender that could excel in the regular season behind a very good team like the ones he's had in Washington and Colorado, but not necessarily someone who is going to be a difference maker on his own if those teams were maybe a little bit more average like we're seeing here in Seattle. Now, I have been told vehemently by my friends in the goalie community that that is wrong, that he is very good, that I didn't know what I'm talking about.
I want to know more about these friends in the goalie community. Sound wild.
Well, they're all killjoys, really.
Oh,
you know,
wow.
You're trying to have fun, and they all want to just take the fun away by stopping.
Checks out.
No, but I'll defer to the experts. I mean, they all tell me that he's the real deal, that he's got the stuff. I've just never been as enamored as others have been with his game. So long answer short, I have confidence that he can be the goalie that they've signed him to be. It's just obviously there's something a little bit off with his game from a tactical standpoint, and then clearly the team in front of him could be a little bit better than it's been in some aspects of its defensive game.
Greg, there's a little bit of a two-parter to this one, but has there been anyone on the Kraken that has quickly established themselves as a legit building block for the future in your eye?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, you know, you look at the ages of the players and you look at the contracts that some of these guys have, and, you know, there are clearly going to be players that are on this roster right now that will still be there once you get the waves of young players. The Kraken will obviously be adding to the roster in subsequent seasons, you know, beginning with Matty Beniers probably, you know, in short order and then going from there. So, you know, you look at a Jared McCann, you look at a Yanni Gourde, and I think that those players are obviously going to be ones that you look at. We mentioned Driedger, he should still be around. I think Vince Dunn should still be around too. So there are definitely players that are on this active roster right now that are going to be viable players even, you know, 2-3 years down the line when you will have a collection of hopefully homegrown Kraken prospects that are going to be surrounding some of the veterans on the roster. But again, like, the other thing too is we saw how this team was built. We heard, you know, management talk about the fact that the Kraken didn't necessarily get the same advantages in the expansion draft that Vegas did, that all the teams around the league smartened up as to how the process should work. So they went about it differently. And I do imagine that there are going to be players on this roster that do have significant trade value that are going to then be flipped for some of the younger players and prospects that you'll eventually see be part of the Kraken's core.
Well, perfect, Greg. You just answered my follow-up question in regards to offloading some assets. So I'm going to defer to Stacey on that. Well, you already took my second part.
All right, I'm just going to ask a quick follow-up. Well, it's not even a follow-up. It's a new question. But just what would you make so far? I know we're only a third of the way into the season about Dave Hakstol's job, like how he's done.
Oof, good question. Good question. You know, again, there are parts of this team that seem like they should be working better than they are based on the underlying numbers. Defensively, again, I think this is a team that that has played better than its goals against average and save percentage would indicate defensively. I think when I've watched the Kraken, and I've seen them a few times, there's a couple of things that really stand out for me vis-a-vis what Dave Hakstol could do. One, I don't know what this team is supposed to be. Like, there are teams around the league that you can point at and say, okay, the Florida Panthers, they run and gun. The Calgary Flames, they don't want you to score. Like there are teams that have a certain personality to them. And I don't know if it's just the newness of the roster and the guys just kind of still finding their way less than 2 months into their existence, or if it's been Dave Hakstol's inability to really imprint something on this game plan. But when I watch the Kraken, I'm not quite sure what I'm supposed to be watching. The other thing, too, is that it seems like outside of a few games this season, they've had an inability to really get both sides of their game on the same page. There are times when I've seen the Kraken really rock and roll offensively, and you know, as a guy who's on the Daily Wager on ESPN2 a few times a week, they hit the over a lot, which is great. But then there are other times when that's going, and then the goaltending and defense isn't. And then I've seen times when they've really locked it down and they can't really get that extra goal that they need to win in a game. So I think one of the things that's really stood out for me is, and I don't know if this speaks to Taxol or not, but like, it's just been an inability to really have both sides of that game going at the same time and finding sustained success through it.
Awesome stuff, Greg, as was expected, of course. He is Greg Wyshynski of ESPN. Make sure you're reading his work at ESPN, and also make sure you're listening to the Puck Soup podcast, a favorite of the show. Thanks so much, Greg.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Greg.
See ya. All right, coming up, we are turning it over to you guys, just as we do every single day. At 1:45, it's What I Need to Know. Get those text questions in. Any question you have, any single question, turning it over to you. 206-421-3776. That's coming your way next.
You're listening to Jake and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacey Rost.
It's What I Need to Know, brought to you by All Right Heating, Cooling, Electric. Get your questions in right now.
Do we have good questions?
We have great questions.
Great questions?
Yeah, okay. We've got this one from the 425.
Okay.
What I Need to Know. Where's the best place to buy a new computer monitor?
Okay.
All the colors in Stacey's sweater burnt out one of mine.
Oh!
Well, that's 425 said that, not me, Stacey.
425. Wow. That is not cool. That's not cool.
I would say like Best Buy. That might be a spot to go. I'm sure Amazon, you could get something off of there.
Yeah, There's nothing wrong with the sweater. Nothing at all. That's it.
Nothing.
Someone said you guys are killing me with your good questions contest. Now, I am currently winning.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am. Wyman has two. Bob has two. I have how many, Curtis? Six. And Jake has five.
No, that has not been updated from week to week. Okay,
absolutely,
that's first and foremost. And then the second thing is that Greg Wyshynski actually meant mine. By the time he got to your good question, he was just throwing it all out willy-nilly.
That's not true. You're mad because I got a Hail Mary in there in the final seconds of the game, and you're trying to say there was like offensive pass interference or take something away from it when you know what happened was that he said, great question.
No. He was just like, oh, I'm just like in a good mood after that great question. Now I'm going to say good question to everybody else.
Mac and Jack's text line. The 253 says, how do we replace Dwayne Brown? It looks like he's definitely tailing off.
I would say that when you're talking about Dwayne Brown for most of the season, he has not looked like the Dwayne Brown we saw last year. But I would say that I've seen improved play from him in particular in the second half of the season from what the first half of the season was. And then the other part that's really hard, and it's also a hard part when you look at Gabe Jackson as well, is that the guys around both of those players have not played well. So it's really hard to determine sometimes. I mean, Dwayne Brown in one-on-one pass rushing situations, he's given up more sacks than we've seen. That is something that you can adequately look at and say, oh, that's just not as good to the eye as what we've seen in the past. Somebody like Gabe Jackson has not performed as well as I would have hoped and I had the expectation of. But also, I think it's the fact that the center position has been really shaky and Brandon Schell has not been healthy for the majority of the year and it just has not played consistently well over the course of the year. So, tough to say, but I think with Dwayne Brown, obviously, he is not at his peak. And you are playing with when is Dwayne Brown going to significantly drop off? And I think that's a huge reason why the Seahawks didn't want to give him an extension past this year that he was seeking. And so we'll have to wait and see what his future holds.
Doug in Tacoma says, what I need to know, do you think the difference in the use of Jamal Adams this year is based on people outside the organization saying he's not a cover safety? Like the team's trying to prove everybody wrong and he was worth what we gave up to get him. Or is it that they're trying to confuse offenses by using him differently? Or neither?
Could you imagine if that was the case? well, we hear that Jamal Adams can't cover. That's what everybody's saying. So we're going to stop doing the thing that works really, really well. And he broke NFL records doing, and we're just going to have him stay back in coverage.
What I do appreciate about the question is, then why?
That's a great question. Great follow-up question. You can put a little tally on a board at home with that, because to me that is something I don't understand quite. Other than the fact that Pete Carroll was never comfortable playing the style of defense that he played this last season in 2020, but they did it, and they got a lot of production out of Jamal Adams for the way that they used him, but he was never comfortable doing that. He would rather elect, I mean, if he had his way, his defense is built off of the concept of our four down linemen are going to beat your five. And that is how we are going to generate pressure. That is how we're going to play great defense. Therefore, we get to drop seven and play zone behind that, and from time to time switch that up and play man-to-man aggressively. That is the epitome of Pete Carroll's defense. That is the comfort zone. And they were hoping that that would be the case this year. That has not been the case at all. And I thought, and I think that that has been a big reason why they have not sent Jamal Adams on blitzes as much this season.
The 509 has a question. Now, before I ask it, I personally think this would be Roger Goodell's dream scenario. What I need to know, says the 509, what are the odds of a Pats versus Bucks Super Bowl? How epic would that be? And I'm going to tack on to this texter's question, although they didn't ask it. If that is not the most epic matchup, then what would be this year? It would have to be an LA team. The NFL would love that.
Yeah, but that to me is not an epic matchup. An epic matchup to me would be something like the Arizona Cardinals and...
versus Hoost. The AFC's been so inconsistent.
Arizona Cardinals and, let's say, the Buffalo Bills or the Chargers. Like, somebody that has not been in the Super Bowl as much but are fun and dynamic to watch.
I do like that because neither the Bills nor Cardinals have won a Super Bowl. So I like the idea that no matter what, one of them will win. Chris, can you think of one?
That's kind of what I'm going.
God, imagine being an AFC team and seeing Tom Brady leave the Patriots. You're like, all right, finally, our window is here. And
here we go.
1 year later, it's like, oh, man. I believe I saw somewhere that the Patriots are the betting favorites to win the AFC right now.
I believe it.
Like, that's...
they've got a great defense.
I would be more mad if the Patriots won a Super Bowl than if Tom Brady went back-to-back.
Really?
I don't like the Patriots organization that much.
And Tom Brady being older and hiring whoever he hired, clearly hired to manage his Twitter account, has made him more likable. And therefore, I agree with your take.
I do, too. That would be so frustrating, though. I agree with Curtis. If you look at it, your window, instead of Tom Brady and Bill Belichick with one team just having a run of dominance, now they're just hogging up the Super Bowl together.
Also, which fans are more insufferable?
Ugh.
Oh, it's Patriots fans.
Well, Patriots fans would look at it as a win on both sides. We saw that last year. All of a sudden, they became Buccaneers fans out of nowhere. Yeah. All of a sudden,
we're
Tom Brady's.
They often call Tampa Bay
the Boston of the South. It's a frequent, people say that all the time.
Gross. No, New England Patriots be like, oh, it's a win-win. I don't care. It's
that
Tom
great
Brady
New
versus...
England clam chowder you get on the shores of Tampa Bay.
It only feels right that we started the show praising Bill Belichick and ended it just panning
hating
the Patriots. I feel healthier doing this. Yeah, you know what I mean?
Feels,
I feel refreshed.
Felt kind of dirty over those
exactly.
First
now
hours.
I feel better. Now I feel much better.
I'm gonna
about
have to
that.
Go home and take a shower.
All right, don't go anywhere. This has been Jake and Stacey. Wyman and Bob coming your way next on 710 ESPN Seattle.